My name is Manuel Solis Jr. I'm a graduate student at Texas A&I University, enrolled in Dr. Leslie G. Hunter's Oral History Seminar, first summer session 1976. Today I'm interviewing Mr. Jose Noe Martinez at the Santo Niño Ranch, located 18 miles south of San Diego. Mr. Martinez is presently employed with the U.S. Department of Agriculture as a soil conservation technician, a job which he has held for 20 years. Although Mr. Martinez is a fairly young man, he is a historian in his own right and a very active member of the Duval County Historical Society. Mr. Martinez, before you talk to us about farming and ranching in and around Duval County, could you please tell us about yourself?
Mr. Solis, I was born in San Diego on October the 30th, 1928. And my father's name is Jose Maria Martinez, born and raised here in Duval County, and so is my mother, Romalda Gonzalez Martinez. I have lived in this place all of my life. My father's occupation was a farmer, with a little cattle on the side, planting mostly cotton and corn, a little hay. We have lived in this neighborhood, the Santo Niño community, for a long time. In this present ranch where I am residing, my father built the first house in 1919, a little after they were married. I might say on the life at that time that since most of our neighbors or relatives, in fact, I would say that within a span of 8 to 10 miles from where I live going south, we are all relatives. So naturally the home life and the social life that we kept was mainly family, visiting each other frequently, the social life, little dances once in a while to celebrate somebody's birthday or a wedding of that nature. I went to school here, started going to school here at the ranch for the first 3 years. Our little schoolhouse built in this community, my teacher was Miss Margarita Garcia from San Diego, and we were about 17 or 18 kids going to school, anywhere from the first grade to the seventh grade, mostly relatives. We had no lighting. We had no heating except an old stove that we used to chop wood, keep it going during the winter to warm ourselves up and warm our lunches. There were no buses. We walked to school. In 1936, when my father passed away, I was 8 years old. My mother and I went to San Diego to stay with my grandfather, at which time I attended the San Diego Public Schools, of which I graduated in 1945. Immediately upon graduation, I came back to the ranch and I started farming. The first year that I farmed, I guess was the best year that I have ever had in my whole life, since I didn't have no equipment to farm with. My uncles, I would help my uncles, and then they would lend me their tractor, and I would farm my little farm here. By the way, I own 208 acres. had about 76 acres in cropland. The rest was all in rangeland. I planted 18 acres of cotton that year, and I raised 6 bales of cotton, which was a big crop for me, being the first one that I ever raised. The price of cotton at that time was around 20 cents, 25 cents, depending on the grade of the cotton. So naturally, we would get approximately $100 per bale. You can see it was not too much money involved in that area. My father always kept a little dairy on the side, and we used to sell sour cream to plant in alleys. That we had a hauler that would come by and pick the cream every day. That would give us everyday money to survive on. We never got rich on it, but we survived. But a couple of years later, went into the grade A dairy business. We built the dairy, and I bought some cows, and I went into the dairy business, producing grade A milk under other conditions, refrigerated milk. They come and pick it up in refrigerated trucks and haul it to Alice and Corpus. I dairied until 1962, when I got to a point that a little operator like I was could not survive in that business, being that the expenses were greater than the income that I was getting. I also had a hand in raising broilers. I had a house built here at the ranch, 100 by 32 feet, and I would house 3,500 broilers in this house for a period of 10 weeks, at which time I would sell them. I raised this kind of chickens for about a year and a half. Then the market fell, and I was not making expenses, so I had to change ways, change jobs. In 1956, the early part of the year, I was visited by Don Allison, who was in charge of the Soil Conservation Service office in Benavides. And a matter of routine visit that he made the ranch, and he talked to me about working for the U.S. Department of Agriculture as a part-time employee. And being that we had a couple of years of bad drought, I decided to work for them on a part-time basis. I started on the 23rd of January, 1956, as a part-time employee, and then on May the 7th of that same year was offered permanent employment, and I've been there ever since. As I say, 6 years later, after I was employed, I quit the dairy business, and I went to raising beef cattle. I have maintained my job in Benavides for this past 20 years, working with farmers and ranchers of this county. I got married in 1949 to Minerva Gonzalez from Alice, and we have 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls, of which I take big pride. 3 of my oldest kids have already graduated from college, the oldest one being a pharmacist, the next 2 girls being teachers. And incidentally, they're both teaching in San Diego. I did not attend or did not serve in the military at all, being that I was caught in between as far as age was concerned. Both in the Korean conflict and World War II. I belong to the Lions Club in Benavides. I'm the past president of that club. I am now the Grand Knight of the Knights of Columbus Council 2781 in San Diego. I also belong to the 4th degree Knights in in Alice. I have been very active in this organization, especially church organizations, being that I was raised in the Catholic Church, and I try to cooperate with my fellow men as much as I can. I was appointed to this historical society, of which I am a member of, about a year ago, and I've always been a nut as far as history is concerned. Collect things that are old and writings that are old and anything that that I think has historical value. And I have before me here an abstract that tells me when this piece of land that I am sitting on right now came into the family, and it was granted to Jose Antonio Gonzalez, heirs, of which I guess I'm one of them, way down the line. And the patent was dated June the 3rd, 1869, and it was signed by Governor E.M. Pease of the state of Texas. Our family has always stayed close together, and at the beginning, of course, there were many acres under one leadership for one of our great-grandparents. But then as the family grew, it was subdivided and subdivided until at the present, there, I guess the biggest ranch around here would probably run around 800 acres. But most of us own anywhere from 100 to 200 acres. And we have stayed with the land. We have stayed with the same customs, or tried to follow the same customs that our people had before us. From conversations that I had with my mother and my uncles, my grandparents, back in the days, in the 1880s, which is as far as back as I know of, that the at that time they raised cattle, they raised sheep. The cattle, incidentally, was raised only to sell the skins and the tallow. And of course, they sold a lot of wool. But being that there was no refrigeration at that time, the meat was either consumed by all the neighbors at one time or given to somebody so that the meat would not be wasted. But, you know, it comes to mind this story that was told to me by my mother. Back in the 80s, one of her great uncles went to, gotten together a carload of wool, and they went to Corpus Christi to sell it. On the way back, they brought, of course, they would bring provisions for them to, last the rest of the year. But as they got back to the ranch, which is about 8 miles south of where I live, El Comité called Santa Cruz, this little comité was situated close to a creek. At one time it was running water, so naturally that's where most of these people settled at the beginning. And they arrived at the ranch late in the afternoon, and they ate supper, and they were sitting by a little lantern counting their money. As you know, at that time, it's all silver. And by the time that that they really got into counting, they were attacked by some bandidos. And they were shot at, and of course, they blew out the lantern, and they started shooting back. And one of this old man's son went out the back door and came, you know, circle around the house, and he was shot by the one inside, and it was killed, an accident, of course. But those were some of the things that they ran into in those days. I don't recall that that we were ever raided, or our people were ever raided by Indians in this neighborhood, as they were a little further north from us. But that was mostly the things that happened to them, was these bandidos either coming from Mexico on the way through or going back, and they would raid these ranches. But most of our people have been peace-loving, and they stayed around the ranches most of their lives. They were born, raised, and died here. Some of them not even going as far as Alice or even Corpus Christi. But they were content. All they wanted was a piece of land where they could plant a little corn or maybe a little cotton and some beans and raise a few pumpkins. Something to sustain themselves and their neighbors. While the others didn't have any, they would share with their neighbors and share their meat and hogs or whatever they had. As far as prices is concerned, I don't know too much about what they sold their wool for, or what they sold their tallow or their skins for at that time. But I can remember back in the 30s that that some of my uncles, you know, when the market crashed, the price of cotton was 50 cents a pound. And some of my uncles stored their cotton. They wanted 60 cents for it, and they stored it to see if it would go up to 60 cents, and the market fell, and they sold it for 5 cents a pound. So, I mean, there have been an ups and downs as far as the farming community is concerned, but people were content with what they had. There was nothing lucrative about anything that they owned, the way they dressed, or the things that that they did socially or otherwise. The biggest social affair of the year, I guess, would be Christmas night. They were all together at one of my aunt's house, Josefa Sainz Barrera, and they would pray a rosary and wait till the 25th came around and start celebrating Christmas then with a big tamale dinner or a big guisote of some kind. But that was it as far as the dances were concerned. There was no places to have dances as far as big buildings was concerned. They had them out in the patios, or if they had a little shed where they could get people inside, they could use for dancing, they would, and they limit the dancers on the floor. In other words, if they had 20 or 30 people that wanted to dance, well, they divide them up into three groups, put a little ribbon on them, a different color ribbon, and now they would say, ahora van los colorados, y después los verdes, and then los azules, you know, in different colors, but they all had a good time, and they enjoyed themselves. I know today that I can't, even though all my neighbors are my kin folks, I seldom get to see them or make time to see them. In that time, in my daddy's time, they used to take off once every month or 2 months to go visit their relatives, and they go from house to house, may spend 2-3 weeks visiting relatives. And all was done with lots of time and little effort as far as money was concerned. They didn't spend very much, you know, going on wagons or horseback or whatever, or buggies that they had during those days. But life in this area has always been easy. No big deal out of it, you know. We've had gas lanterns up to 1949, when the first time we ever got electricity down to our farms. ¿Estás devolviendo?
No.
Speaking about my dad, Jose Maria Martinez, as I said, he was born here in this area. But as a little boy, when his sister was born, their mother died. So they went to live with their grandmother in Escobares, Texas, which is a little community west of Rio Grande City. And they spent their, I guess, if he wasn't a teenager, in that area. But all the time coming back, you know, once in a while, to visit with the kin folks down here. My dad grew up in a farming community and a ranching community, so naturally he was a horseman. And of course his biggest pride was to have a good horse. And he would compete in what they had, the tardeadas, whatever they called them at that time here, roping contests. They did not plant too many acres at the time, being that they had to use either oxen or mules. But they all planted a little bit of everything, maybe 25 or 30 acres per family, divided amongst corn and little hay for their animals and cotton, little beans and maybe a few rows of watermelons and pumpkin. As far as working, earning outside money, well, they didn't actually work for wages. They helped each other out. If somebody had to round up, he would go up there and help them round up and get the cattle in the pens, or mark them, or do to the cattle what was supposed to be done at that time. But I can remember him telling me that they picked cotton for 25 cents a hundred, 35 cents a hundred, 50 cents a hundred. And it was very common in those years that you would work all day for 25 cents. And that wasn't an 8-hour day, that was sun up, sun down. And those that looked for employment, most of the work was either clearing new land or feeding cattle, mostly burning pear. In fact, I have an uncle that, named Jesus Guerra, who worked for many years at 25 and 35 cents a day. Of course, at that time, you know, 25 cents would buy a lot of things that you couldn't buy today, but anyway, that was the wages that they earned during those years. As far as selling the cattle or anything like that, well, it's very seldom that somebody would come around and buy their cattle on the hoof, or maybe get together and in a drive and take them up north to San Antonio or somewhere to sell them. But most of the selling that they did was mostly for skins and tallow, as I had already said. The things that they raised, with the exception of cotton, they kept. The corn was kept at the farm, and beans, and for their own consumptions, and for the consumption of the animals that they had, whether they were mules or horses. But you know, I have with me a bill of sale that can just to give you a little illustration as to what things were selling for. This man sold 7 head of horses for the price of $35, and they were anywhere from age 3 to 5 years, and the same man that bought them, and this bill of sale that I have here in my hand, bought them for $35, and then turned around and sold them the same day for $25. So you see that they didn't make very much profit from their where they were buying and selling, but mostly they just traded amongst each other. We used to have I remember when I was a little boy that our post office was in a little community called Santa Cruz, and remained there for a long time. But before that, they had another little place they called Mazatlán. Of course, there's nothing left of that particular community. There's nothing. The old post office burned down, and they moved it to this other place, Santa Cruz, and eventually we now get all our mail in Concepción. But they're all little communities that were started by some kin folks of ours. Back in the 1910 to 1920 era, our farming here, I guess, could not be compared to other farming areas in the county, being that most of what our people raised was either consumed by themselves or by the animals that they raised. You take, for instance, the city of Benavides or San Diego, and I mean the farming people or the farming areas around that those little towns. Well, those people could make a little extra money sometimes, maybe by if they didn't have anything to sell, they could take wood and sell wood to the people that lived in town, or to the gins that were in operation, cotton gins, or even to the railroad, as they were, a railroad used to run in steam engines. But in this area, since we were further away, I think that most of the things that were planted or raised were used on the farm, except maybe for the little cotton. And most of our cotton either went to Benavides, to Canjin Benavides, or San Diego, or maybe Palito Blanco, which is a little community about 9 miles northwest of this area. As far as other things that they planted, let's say like watermelons, which is a big crop nowadays, people didn't plant that many. They just planted enough to eat themselves and to give to their neighbors or their friends, but never for sale. You know, back in those days, the amount of farming that was done was in small scale. As I said before, being done with mules or oxen. So they couldn't afford to plant big acreage. And as far as diseases for their crops, well, my dad never mentioned anything about it, except that the biggest enemy was drought. And of course, we have to live with that even nowadays. When my dad married in 1919, you know, right after he got married, they had this big storm that hit Corpus Christi. And my parents say that they raised, all the families around here raised lots of cotton that year, and it was all piled up and picked in the fields when it rained. But it rained so much that some of those piles were just, the water just washed them away and spread them out all over the pastures and the little fences that they had or in amongst the trees. Another thing that by that time, you know, most of our people had water wells. They were either hand dug or had the old cable tool, which one of my uncles was a well driller. Used to run this cable tool with horses or mules. And, or maybe they would dig them up to 100 foot deep and set windmills on them. But after that storm, most of the windmills were blown down by the tremendous amount of wind that they had. And, there was a lot of damages to their houses and the little belongings that they had, since most of the houses were of the jacal type, you know, the, maybe, made out of clay. My granddad had a house made out of caliche blocks, you know, and of course that withstood the storm very well. But other people that didn't have the means to build those kind of houses will suffer because their houses were blown down or damaged in some way or another, or even if they were out of clay, you know, just as much rain as they had, they just kind of melted off. But most of my grandparents and his brothers, there was a, and you can still see them, the houses made out of caliche blocks that they hired people who did that kind of work. And it was rocks out of the same area. They pick out one of these hills and they cut those blocks off of those caliche hills. Most of these houses were one room, one big room, maybe a few divisions inside, made from cloth or some kind of material. There was no inside facilities of any kind, running water or showers or bathrooms, none of that sort. I mean, they were all outhouses. It was interesting to notice that on all these brick houses, or this is not brick, but caliche block houses, that most of them didn't have their kitchen there. The kitchen was another little house away from the main house. And of course, the farm workers that were living there or the relatives had smaller houses all around the windmill or where they had the water. And my mother keeps telling me, you know, that their biggest joy was when they had a big rain and all of this natural lakes form, you know, that we have amongst our rangeland here were full of water, that their biggest thrill was to go out there and wash their clothes in these lagoons, and when they were through, they would go in for a swim. And naturally, that being rainwater, the water was very soft, and any kind of soap would work real fine. You know, there was always something going on at each farm. But if it was during the winter, close to Christmas time or Thanksgiving, November, it was time to kill hogs, and they would invite all the neighborhood and start early in the morning and kill the hog and render the Lord. They would also make chicharrones or cracklings. They would also make a special dish that we call morcilla, which is a little bit of everything. And of course, the meat was all either consumed that day or dispersed amongst their neighbors. But this was a typical day that my family had when it was hog killing time. Now, by this time, in the late 20s, I would say that we had one of our great uncles by the name of Agapito Sainz, who got to amaze by 1916 something like 9,000 acres. I say by 1916 because he passed away in 1916, leaving all his properties to Manuel Sainz Escobar. And of course, Mr. Escobar had a big family, and it's all been divided amongst the heirs. And at the present, I believe that the heirs now hold something around 600 acres per family. But things rolled around to the 20s, right after the war, and after the big hurricane, and people got adjusted, repaired their houses, and got back on what they knew how to do best, which was farm a little and raise cattle. And you know, it's very interesting to know that in the 20s, for the first time, that people started selling their cattle to
outside buyers that would come and buy them by the hoof. One of the biggest buyers in our area was Mr. Richard Skidmore, and he would pay $10 a head for calves, say, weighing 200 to 300 pounds, and he would mark them in a way by taking a piece of the ear or cutting off his tail, and would pay $5 down. Then the rancher agreed to hold the cattle for another 90 days, at which time he would pay the other $5, which was $10 a head. Now he would get or form a cattle drive either to Benavides or San Diego, where he would ship them by rail. But the price kept getting better as the years went by. Towards 1926, 27, they were getting as much as 37 cents for cotton. And but then in 28, down to the latter part of 31, 32, there was their market came down to 7 cents to 8 cents a pound of cotton. And the calves were selling for $7 a head, and the cows for $20 a head. So you see, the people in my community just kept on surviving, like I guess any other community. But with what they ate, what they raised, and they sold what they had to sell at prices that were available to them. Another thing that came during the 20s was the prohibition. And of course they had big tequileros or tequila runners from the Rio Grande River to this area. There were a few that were brave enough to venture into this kind of business, even though they were partly they were pursued by the Texas Rangers, and some of them got shot at, and some of them quit, but some of them had a little more bravery in them and just stayed on with the business. An uncle of mine told me that the runners would pay $2 a bottle of tequila in Mexico, and they hauled it all the way up to this area and sold it for $2.25 to $3. But everybody had a little bit stashed away somewhere, even though the rangers were hot on their trails. But they managed to hide this contraband in tickets, brush tickets, and some in this natural lake that were full of water. They just go up there in burlap bags and put all these bottles in underwater. And as the customers came by, they go up there to the lagoon and go fetch them a bottle, or two or three, whichever they wanted. But another thing that they did was that they would brew beer, homebrew, we called it. And mostly everybody learned how to do it. There was no refrigeration, so they drank the beer just as it was. And of course, it made them real sick the day after. But mostly everybody would learn how to do it, or had a relative who knew how, and they would take the necessary materials, which was sugar and some kind of molasses and yeast, and they would brew this this batch, and most of the time they drank it before it got ripe enough to drink it. Then they got sick. When the market crashed, of course, my families didn't lose very much money like they did in the big cities, I guess, and the people that had money in the banks. But most of my family's belongings were at home. They kept the little money that they owned stashed away somewhere in the house. So naturally, along those lines, they didn't use the bank for anything. So naturally, they didn't lose any money to the market. But they lost because, of course, the prices went down and everything went to pot, as we might say today. But during those years when finally the Democrats came into power, when with President Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, things began to pick up a little bit. There was more employment offered to the farmers up here. They widened all the county roads, and they chopped the excess brush that was along the road. They made them wider, and they graded them. And people got a little help from federal monies. Also, the farmer was paid for not raising crops. The price of cotton at that time was 11 and 12 cents a pound, but they were paid so much an acre for not planting a certain amount of the crop. And by that time, also in 1932-33, we had our first agriculture office here in the county. Mr. Hilmer Hagelin was our county agent, and a brand new county agent, I might say, and Ravelito Hinojosa was in charge of the AAA office, which is the agricultural office, in charge of paying these subsidies to the farmers and ranchers. Of course, in 1931, and there were programs also that would pay the farmers or the big ranchers to kill off some of the cattle, and it didn't hurt our community at all, because of course we were all small producers, and they didn't participate in this program. But there were several in the county that killed off some of the stock to got paid for them by the federal government to reduce the amount of cattle that in the area, and of course create a demand for it, but the prices would come up. I know that most of the farmers in that area, in that era, I remember that because I was a little boy, that we were still stricken by drought, you know, once in a while, and our crops weren't all in tip-top shape, and they were always waiting for that little check from the government to kind of hold them through. But they made it. A little cotton they could raise, a little corn. Of course, at that time, we're still farming with mules and horses. There was no sign of a tractor. In fact, I could say that about 1937, the first tractor was came into our community. It was bought by one of my uncles, Anastasio Sainz, and it was a two-row four-mile tractor, tricycle type. Everybody went out there to see the tractor. Nobody had seen a tractor before, I guess, and made a big deal out of it, but pretty soon, as war broke out in Europe and things started looking up a little bit better, people went, started little dairies, selling sour cream and getting a little subsidy for it from the federal government to encourage production. And this went on all during the late 30s and even during the beginning of World War I. World War II, and they were getting subsidies for producing cream and producing milk products. They were getting subsidies for producing cotton. Incentives, I would say, not subsidies, but incentives so that these people would plant more and raise more. And of course, at that time, I could see that the beginning of using of a little fertilizer, little poisoning for the cotton to get rid of our diseases or pink bollworm and boll weevil. And of course, the agriculture department came by and checked on these people to destroy their cotton stock and help out with other things that that were available to the farmers and ranchers. And this happened all during the early 40s. The two offices that were held here in the county was, of course, the AAA and the county agent. The county agent, Mr. Hagelin, I remember he learned speaking Spanish here when he came down. He married one of the Hoffman girls out of San Diego, and they stayed in San Diego for a long time. And he would hold all these meetings. I remember being a little boy, I used to go to him, and he'd bring certain kind of demonstrations on certain crops or certain breeds of cattle, and in trying to get these farmers and ranchers to improve their herds and improve their croppings and what have you. Right after the war, in 1945, I was still in school that year. I graduated in May. Of course, the war ended in that month in Europe, and then in August it was the end in Japan. I went to the farm and started farming, and as I said before, I farmed 1 year with the help of my uncle's equipment, and then after raising that good crop that I had, I bought myself a tractor and I started farming. I kept the dairy that my mother had started before, and we had some people working for her, and I took over the dairy and started selling sour cream and started selling whole milk to the cheese factory. And again, we had a hauler to come down and pick the milk every morning and haul it to Alice for the cheese factory. After this, you know, it got to a point where some of my neighbors started building these grade A dairy barns and selling grade A milk to the boarding company in Alice and later to Corpus. I got into the business also. In 1945, the people here organized a soil and water conservation district, and it was called the Aupita Soil and Water Conservation District. It was named after one of our creeks that goes through the county. And we started to get in little extra help from the Soil Conservation Service. And of course, most of the help at that time was terracing, and of course the terracing program was started by Mr. Hagelin. He would be the engineer, lay out these terrace lines across the slope to conserve water, help the crops. And there were two men that I know of that were building this. They were local people. One of them was Mr. John Burchett from San Diego, and the other one was Alejandro Montemayor from Senior, from San Jose community. And they provided a little extra income for these people, and of course we had tractors at that time also. And mostly everybody started selling off their mules and buying tractors and working the land and using better methods. As I mentioned before, that the first agricultural office that we had here in the county was, of course, our county agent and the AAA. The AAA office later became the ASAS office today. In the early 50s, it was called PMA, Production Marketing Administration, of which in 1951-52, I was a member of the PMA committee. We had three members that ran the program. At that time, this office helped farmers and ranchers to apply certain practices with a certain percentage of money provided by the federal government. As I said, the Soil Conservation Service was brought into this county in 1948, after the district was organized in 1946, and The district had five directors that ran the district program, a subdivision of the state of Texas. This district was run like a school board or a school district. They regulate policy, and these directors are not paid any compensation except for mileage to and from monthly meeting that they had or any special meeting that they had during the year. But the Department of Agriculture, through its different outlets, as I said, that I had mentioned before, has certainly changed around the farming aspect of and the ranching aspect of this county, and of course the area of where I live. As the tractors began to get better, better equipment, better. Instead of two rows, they were getting four row equipment, started farming, they would farm more land. One man could farm 100 to 200 acres very easy. By this time, we had quite a bit of terracing done in the area, in our crop land, and the people were following the terraces and farming and getting a little better production out of their crops. Of course, one thing leads to another. You know, when you have better seeds to plant, all the hybrids start coming in, and better breeds of cattle. We started crossing our old cattle that we had here, the old Hereford cattle with Braemar cattle, and getting some of the truest cattle into this area, and of course, it started improving the quality of our beef. By this time, in the middle 50s, I imagine that it was very hard to see somebody working with mules. Mostly everybody had a tractor, or could have or had access to one. Through the years, the Soil Conservation Service has provided assistance to all of these farmers and ranchers, not only in applying conservation measures that would conserve our soil and water, but also on other aspects of the cropping systems that we had. The Soil Conservation Service assisting this district would formulate what we call a soil and water conservation plan. It's a long-range plan, conservation plan, in which we try to treat each acre within its capabilities and to get more production out of it. And of course, to get at this end, we had to, in our crop land, we have to use better seeds and better farming methods and better fertilizer, and then diversify our crops in a way that we wouldn't plant the same crop but on the same place year after year as it was done before. This led to almost to this day that we plant very little cotton here in this county. Most of our crops or in the grain sorghum varieties, forage sorghums, and very little corn, to watermelons, crop farming like cucumbers, squash, and things of that nature. Even this past year, we had, well, the last 2-3 years, we've had some wheat planted in this area. And it has done real good. Of course, in the lower part of the county and in south of where I live, they have dug a few wells and have done a little irrigating on the side. Some people have tried it and do not succeed because of the quality of the water, but there are some that have good quality water and have enough to plant maybe 100, 125 acres of irrigated land per well, but most of our irrigation is done on watermelons, which is a big crop in the southern part of this county. In all these areas, the Soil Conservation Service through the district provided assistance to the farmer and rancher on all kinds of problems that they might have at the ranch. And through the efforts of these people, that we have a lot of it on the ground. Our budget, which is a big problem in this area, you know, my uncle used to tell me that when they used to ride horseback from where I live down to close to Rio Grande City, that sometimes when they needed to tie their horse, they couldn't find a tree or anything to tie their horses to except grass. Now, today, most of this land is all grown up in brush and trees that are not productive to cattle or to any other animal. So naturally, the department tries to look for ways to improve their land and at the same time provide the necessary grasses that both domestic animals and our wildlife can use. And it has proven to be very successful. Early in the 1950s, this buffalo grass, which we see everywhere here in South Texas, was introduced into this county. Mr. J. E. Tilton, who was chairman of the board at that time, in fact, he was one of the originators of the district, planted some. It took about a year and a half to begin to notice it. But once it started raining and started growing, it caught on fire, and then everybody was planting it everywhere. Even in our brushlands, where they would root plow it and remove the brush or try to remove the brush. We have never come up with a complete brush eradication program because it just can't be done. We have tried a lot of methods and like chaining and chopping and tree dozing, root plowing and raking. But the only way that you can get rid of all your brush is to clear it completely and plant it in a row crop for 2-3 years, and then of course you get rid of all your brush. But naturally, some of these people do not have the land for cropland production. It is mostly land that can be used for cattle. So in the ranchland field, which is about 90% of our land here in the county, all of these practices have been explained to all the farmers and ranchers, and they have been followed. Cross fencing, their bigger pastures, and providing more water facilities, and taking all what is needed on the land and to have more production is what they're after. At present time, we have two programs under which the farmer and rancher gets assistance from. One is the annual agriculture conservation program, and the other one is the long-term agreements, of which we have about 8 or 9 participating right now. The annual program is the same as we have had for the last 20 or 30 years, in which the federal government provides assistance to implement some of these practices that are needed at the farm. Now, this long-term agreement that I was talking about is a contract entered into by this farmer or rancher with the federal government, in which the federal government provides assistance for a period of not less than 3 but not more than 10 years. To apply these practices, and of course it's a contract, and they're obligated to do this work. It has proven very effectively. But you know, when I started working with the service, things weren't as good as they are right now. Of course, we were referred to as the people that built the terraces, and that was about all that we could offer at that time, but the people accepted it for. But you know, the Mexican American people in our community are funny sometimes, and they don't heed to new ideas very quick. But they'll come around, and they'll get lined up. But they got to see what the other people are doing and things of that nature. But I would sometimes I would try to talk to a man about applying some practice, whether it was terracing or doing some brush work, and he would tell me yes and agree with me 100%, but then he wouldn't come around to doing it. And first thing I know is just maybe I'm talking just through my head and not getting anything accomplished. But these people finally came around, and they would see what others were doing. They don't like to try anything new at their own expense. They want somebody else to try it for them, which I guess is all right. But that was one of the biggest problems that I had. Another one was that in my community, you know, most of my uncles and relatives that live there, they wouldn't accept me as a technician because they saw me grow up, and I was using the same methods that they were using, and everything was running around fine, and they would not keep to new ideas. But it just took a little more effort on my part and a little more understanding on theirs, and finally we got to where I think that my community is very aggressive in this part of the work. We were the first that I think to get together and plan a complete terrace system for two or three owners at one time, and running one terrace from one field to the other. Whenever we did brush work, we all got together and did it all at the same time. So that naturally has helped us. On my job, you know, when I started working, as I said, terracing was a big thing. Today, at present, it just covers a multitude of sins, I might say, because not only do we work with the farmers and ranchers on their specific conservation problems, we also work with the units of government, like cities, schools, county officials, commissioners, on any problem that they might have that affects conservation. At one time, you know, during the atomic bomb scare, the art department was in charge of monitoring in case we did have a sneak attack of some kind, and we learned how to use a Geiger counter and take readings, and were trained for this particular job, which was not even related to the agricultural field. Of course, we had to monitor foodstuff that was on the ground when, even when an atomic bomb was dropped on us. But we eventually still do it locally, as we belong to the civil defense, but not as a department like we used to. But on a normal day, I would like to say that when I go out, and of course we make our schedules a week in advance, and we schedule visit different farms or the different problems, and of course some of the ranchers come to us and schedule certain days. But on a normal day, I visit with the farm. I go over the conservation plan with him. I discuss the things that he has applied and that he's doing a good job, and then I discuss with him the things that that need to be done and how he can do them and how much it would cost, and what help is available to him, and all of those things that that pertain to those problems that he might have. My job is very enjoyable. You meet lots of people of all types, I might say. I enjoy working in this field. it's an open field. I wish we had more people that would be interested in agriculture, because I feel that agriculture is the backbone of any country. I feel that we're going to need the foodstuff from now on, as long as we survive as people. And I think that that we're doing, and my department is doing, a terrific job towards this end, where we can bring to the people in town and the people all over the world some foodstuff that would be easy to buy and cheap to buy, and at the same time for it to be a whole diet that they can survive on.